May it please the court, Jeff Allen. I am the section chief of the transportation section in the Attorney General's office, and I'm happy to be here today to address this court on the issues here. To start with, I'm going to cover two issues, and then Tesla will cover a third. The two issues that I would like to cover, although I'm open to the court's question on any issue, certainly, is jurisdiction before this court, because I know that there was some interest in that, and some of the orders indicated an interest to us, and then sovereign immunity, as that plays into all of this. A lot of these issues tend to converge in this particular case. It's an APA case, obviously, that was appealed to the circuit court.
Let me start with that initial concept of whether we do have jurisdiction, whether this is an appealable order.
Yes, sir.
It seems to me that your whole argument is based on the issue of sovereign immunity. That if the Commonwealth were not a party to this suit, there'd be no question that this was not an appealable order. Is that a fair reading?
Your Honor, that's a very interesting question. Initially, I would say that our approach was that, after much discussion. As this court knows, a lot of these issues are determined by the General Assembly on how precise you read the statute. And if you look at this court's jurisdiction regarding APA cases, 17.1-405(4), okay, the applicable language says that in any aggrieved party, okay, and arguably, whether I'm correct or not, and I'm not trying to argue for Tesla, I'm trying to answer your question, Your Honor, any aggrieved party, which could include Tesla, may appeal to the Court of Appeals from any final decision, yada, yada, of an administrative agency, and I know it's not a final decision, but it does deal with the decision of an administrative agency. And then you go to 4. Any interlocutory decree or order entered in any of the cases listed in the section, which is an APA case, and then the applicable part of that clause, adjudicating the principles of the cause. Okay? So we've got any aggrieved party can bring an action to this court, arguably, adjudicating the principles of the cause.
Well, would you agree that if this were a case involving two individuals, if it, say, rose in the context of a divorce, that this would not be an appealable interlocutory order? If one of the parties was, the issue was standing, the trial court ruled that they had standing, under our decision in DeHaan and a number of Supreme Court decisions, this would not be appealable.
Yes, Your Honor. And in the Erickson case, as you know, this court has laid out, okay, how we determine, okay, principles of the cause. And one of the three areas that the court looks at is the chief objective of the cause or the action. And I think you have to focus in this case on that chief objective. And I would boil it down after much thought, okay, and I commiserate with the court who has handled principles of the cause cases. Until you get used to the idea, it is a difficult concept. But the chief objective seems to me that it is a legal review of an agency decision, and watch this now, by an aggrieved party, okay? So you have to have all of those elements there. And here, the aggrieved party, okay, only has the right to the legal review by the circuit court.
As we're sitting here now, we have a judicial decision by the trial court that the VADA is an aggrieved party. And for us to be able to consider that, we have to have jurisdiction, which means it must be an order that adjudicates the principles of cause.
That's correct.
The principles of the cause here are whether Tesla can sell cars in Richmond. That's the ultimate principle that the circuit court is being asked to consider.
Well, I would beg to differ respectfully. I think the principles of the cause in this is whether or not there is a legal review by the circuit court of that decision, and this court has over and over and over said professional associations, the Bideson case, which you authored, Your Honor, says that you have to have an aggrieved party. An aggrieved party means something in the law. You have
That's the merits. That's the merits that we would have to get to. My problem, I'm winding in, you know, the sovereign immunity and the standing. It seems to me that your argument is they don't have standing because of sovereign immunity, but that requires us to decide the ultimate issue of whether they have standing or not up front. And that's the issue that we're prevented from reviewing based on the non-appealable order.
Right, but you know, thinking about this, and I know, Justice Fields, you've written on sovereign immunity. I think probably most of you have been on panels that have done that. But isn't the sovereign immunity designed to create, the legislature creates the waiver and creates the process that makes a suit not so vexatious, that gives the public the right to challenge it in spite of the sovereign immunity? So we have cases that time after time after time say that you have to follow the specified procedure or it's waived.
Is it sovereign immunity?
Not waived.
Tell me how I'm wrong in this idea. Sovereign immunity, it appears to me, is a claims-based defense. That it's a question of whether the state has authorized a lawsuit based on a certain type of claim. It's not a party-based concept.
Right.
It's not you can sue the state, but you can't sue the state, even though the facts are the same.
Right.
So it seems to me you're arguing basically here that it is a party-based authorization for suit because it can only be invoked if you have standing.
Well, the standing issue in this case, Your Honor, appears to me by the statute to be interwoven with, and the nature of the idea of party aggrieved is interwoven with the objective of the action, which is the legal review that only an aggrieved party is entitled to. And the sovereign immunity protects that. And if the aggrieved party is not an aggrieved party, as we would suggest in this appeal, then there is no remedy, okay?
Can I follow up then on that and Judge Petty's earlier question?
Yes, Your Honor.
If this were not involving sovereign immunity and it was the denial of a demurrer by a circuit court on appeal to us, we would not have jurisdiction, would we?
I think you would, but the sovereign immunity makes it stronger, even stronger, because we can't get that immunity back. If we undergo the trial, the immunity's gone.
Can you tell me what case you would cite to support the concept that this is an appealable interlocutory order under the facts that Judge Beals just mentioned? Because all of the cases that I've seen...
Make sure I understand your question first, Your Honor. I'm not sure I do.
If this were just an appeal of a denial of a demur, he said, we would not have jurisdiction. And I thought your response was, I think you would. And I want to know under what theory, what case would give us jurisdiction in a case that didn't involve the Commonwealth and sovereign immunity.
Well, let me first of all say we do have sovereign immunity. DMV clearly does. And so that adds extra reason, if you will, from a legal standpoint, that this matter should be dismissed on an interlocutory appeal.
So that's your argument. That is a major principle of the cause.
Yes, it
is.
It's
got to be adjudicated.
Yes, it is. And without making Tesla's argument, okay, the question that you've asked is, if you would presume perhaps, in an APA appeal, the Commonwealth doesn't have to come in.
I need to let you know, too, you're going into your colleague's time, but please finish your answer.
The Commonwealth doesn't have to come in. The court can do that legal review on their own with perhaps a TASLA or a third party participating.
And if I could ask you, I know I'm cutting your time, so I apologize, but very quickly, if we accept your argument, I assume then we have to address the issue of whether they do in fact have standing.
Yes, because the statutory scheme indicates that they have to be an aggrieved party to get that legal review.
Thank you.
If you have no further questions, I'll cede my time to Tesla and follow up and rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Good morning, Mr. Liflin.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Charles Liflin for Tesla. I was prepared to address standing, but I think I might say a few words on jurisdiction as well, since Your Honors obviously are concerned about that. I see it really as the flip side of the standing issue in this context of a jurisdictional appeal, because a person can sue the state for legal review of an administrative case decision only to the extent that the state has, the legislature, has waived sovereign immunity from that suit, and only on the terms that the legislature has specified. And those terms are, under the APA, that the person bringing the suit has to be a party aggrieved and has to meet that legal standard. So in that sense, it is a party-based test. I think there I would agree with Mr. Allen that it's intertwined. It's not simply a claims-based test. You do have to look at who the party is to determine whether there's been a waiver of sovereign immunity for this case. And that's really the key to jurisdiction here. I would agree with Your Honor that the question of whether the person can bring the state to answer in its own courts, that is, pierce the sovereign immunity of the state, is an essential principle of the cause in a case like this. I would agree with Judge Petty that it doesn't arise in other cases in a typical standing situation, for example, in a divorce case. I would agree there wouldn't be jurisdiction. What makes it an appealable interlocutory issue here is this notion of sovereign immunity, and in particular the notion that it's lost. It's decided by this decision for all time if there's no review. It definitely affects the legal rights of the parties. It will necessarily affect the final order. The reason it's lost is because sovereign immunity is not simply immunity from liability at the end of the case, which could be decided at final judgment. It's the immunity from suit, from being held to answer if you're the state in your own court.
Let me ask you on that, though, because I understand your argument. Yeah. It's like once the bell has been rung, essentially, right? But if we don't have jurisdiction, I mean, just say if, we haven't decided, of course, which is why we appreciate your argument on this, but if we did not have jurisdiction now, why, when this is eventually decided on the principles of the cause and it's appealed to us, if it were appealed to us then, why wouldn't we have jurisdiction to consider everything then, including the sovereign immunity argument? It's like, well, circuit court may have been wrong.
You would have jurisdiction to include everything at the end. The question is whether there is a right to interlocutory appeal under this concept of principles.
I'm sorry, I thought you were saying that once if we didn't take it now, we couldn't. The sovereign immunity question had essentially been resolved.
Oh, well, let me explain what I meant by that. One of the components of sovereign immunity is the right to be free of the suit.
To get it dismissed, essentially.
To get it dismissed, not to be called to answer in court. That part of it is gone. Because they would have to then go through the case, and then at the end, they would have to get a ruling on
liability. But we had an order from the circuit court saying that effectively the Commonwealth has waived sovereign immunity because VADA does have standing. We have to, in order to review that order, it has to be adjudicate the principles of the cause, and the principles of the cause go far beyond whether there's been a waiver of sovereign immunity, whether they have standing.
Well, the principles of the cause don't have to encompass every issue in the case, Your Honor. If that were true, there wouldn't be any interlocutory appeal. Everything would be a final... in any case, there would only be final judgments. This is clearly an essential principle.
De Haan, I think, pretty much puts a stake in the heart of the concept that there is an appealable interlocutory order in a civil proceeding. I agree with you that I can't imagine an order declaring the principles of deciding the principles of cause might be, but De Haan is still good law.
Yes, but it's not an APA case, and that's what's the distinction here. I don't think this court has considered this in an APA case where the issue is whether there's been an erroneous decision that has terminated the sovereign immunity, which ought to be recognized from point one in the case. That's what makes a difference. I don't think that's been considered in any of these other cases, Your Honor.
So essentially, APA cases, as we know, have some differences from other civil cases on appeal to us.
That's correct.
Just in the standard of review and a number of things.
That's correct, and it's not an unusual principle we're arguing for. I think, as we've cited in the briefs, I think it's pretty much black-letter law in almost all jurisdictions that denials of immunity are immediately appealable on an interlocutory basis. Now, here, it's got to be fit within this concept of principles of the cause under the statute.
But all of those cases that are cited deal with states that don't have the same interlocutory appeal language Virginia does.
It's all a little different, and the question is, how do you fit it within the framework? And our position is that within the principles of the cause language, this can be fit in the framework based on the arguments that we've made in the briefs. If the court doesn't have any more questions on that issue, I could turn briefly to the underlying standing issue. It's clear that under Virginia law, a party doesn't have standing to sue under the APA as the representative of another party. The law doesn't recognize representational standing in the associational sense. That's in the Pearsall case. And I don't think VADA is arguing otherwise in this case. What they have put forward in light of that are a string of arguments where they're asserting that there is some individual standing here. And we would submit, and I won't have time to go into them all, they're addressed in the brief, that none of them hold water. I mean, there's this claim based on the contract, the settlement agreement from the prior case from 1983, the earlier case of Tyson's Corner, 2013, where they contend that the settlement agreement said that Tesla and the DMV had agreed that they could not even be another application for a new dealership. Well, they brought that exact same claim in Fairfax County Court and lost. As to the DMV, the court held there is no waiver of sovereign immunity for a claim for equitable relief under the contract. As to Tesla, the court held on the merits, this contract says the opposite of what you, VADA, are claiming. It says it doesn't prevent another application for a dealership. And what we have here is an attempt to rebring the same claim via an administrative proceeding. There's still no sovereign immunity waiver on the government's part for the contract claim. And the administrator, or I should say the commissioner, held quite rightly that he didn't have any authority to adjudicate a contract claim in that proceeding. So that's not a basis for standing. We also have this argument that it's a de facto regulation. I would submit that that's nonsense. The notion that the commissioner, because he allegedly misapplied the burden of proof, according to VADA, has that somehow issued a regulation is wrong. It's still a case decision. But the more important point is, even if it was a case decision, the law is clear that it still has to be challenged under the person aggrieved standard. It's only formally promulgated notice and comment regulations that are excused from that standard.
Why
so that is
potential automobile dealers then, who the Virginia Automobile Dealers Association tried to have as interveners, why wouldn't they be in that position then?
Well, there was an amendment to add them. The problem they have here is if VADA doesn't have standing, again, it's black letter law. We cited the Chesapeake House case. They can't cure that by then attempting to amend their petition to add someone whom they say does have standing. That's not something they can do. The dealers, if they wanted to bring a petition, would have to bring a petition of their own. They'd have to do it on a timely basis. The jurisdictional time for that has run out. And there's also a serious question, and we've briefed this as well. It wasn't replied to. The dealers themselves don't have standing. You know, this statute doesn't give a dealer a right to a dealership. It just specifies a condition for a manufacturer to be allowed to operate a dealership. Tesla wouldn't have to give a dealership to anybody if it didn't want to.
Who does have standing to challenge the ruling by the DMV here?
And please answer Judge Petty's question, and your time will be expired. I will give you both your rebuttal time because we've had a lot of questions.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. It would only be an aggrieved party under the situation that the legislature has set up.
That's my question. Hypothetically, who would be an aggrieved party in a case like this?
If a dealer doesn't have standing, and we would contend that they didn't, in a situation where the court had found, made the finding under the statute that was requested, there would not be an aggrieved party. That's the way the legislature
is. So there would be no appeal.
There is no
appeal.
That's true of any administrative decision where there's not an aggrieved party. That's the line the legislature has set for allowing sovereign immunity to be pierced in this situation. We don't have a system where anybody who disagrees with a case decision can sue the government over it unless they meet the standard for
aggrieved party. Didn't we hold I think it was Reston Hospital case, that an economic interest was sufficient to make you an aggrieved party?
That was an economic interest by a competing
hospital,
which was in the jurisdiction, and under the statute, the beds and other facilities offered by that hospital had to be considered in the context of whether a certificate of need could be approved, and so that you held that was an aggrieved party. That's not the same situation as this statute. There is no existing competitor. The only question is there somebody available? But even if the court were to conclude that was enough for standing, and we've cited the Clare case as our authority that it wouldn't be, it doesn't matter in this case because VADA didn't have standing and they can't now amend to bring in other parties.
Thank you.
Let you go over, so I will also give your opposing counsel some extra time.
Good morning. My name is Brad Weiss. I represent VADA in both cases. Let me give you the title to this case, as I call it, the cart before the horse case. And I say that to begin with because the first part that you don't have that counsel hasn't told you about is you don't have the complete record. Even if there was a basis for jurisdiction, they did not transmit the entire record to this court. So even if you wanted to entertain this as an interlocutory appeal, which I don't believe is appropriate under the statute, the facts, and the cases, under the Supreme Court Rule 2A:3B and C, you have not received the entire record for which you could then consider everything and all of the issues they've raised, including the issues they've raised that have not been adjudicated by the underlying court. Let me explain why, and let me cite to you in the record. So if you look at the June 26, 2017 hearing transcript, pages 53, 54, August 24th, transcript pages 24 and 25, the appendix 001393 and 1394, you'll see where it's raised. The record from the administrative proceeding was not transmitted to the circuit court because the commissioner office asked for additional time, complained that it would take more time. I raised the issue that they could transmit the index. They continually ask for more time, so the circuit court does not yet have the complete record And so when they decided to take the strategy of an interlocutory appeal, this court, by definition, could not, does not have the complete record for
where,
which...
Can you give me the numbers in the joint appendix that you were referring to again?
Yes, sir. That would be 001393 and 1394, in which it is cited. So you do not, and I can represent to you as an officer of the court, you do not have the complete record. Even if you wanted to decide that you have jurisdiction, which I will now tell you why you don't, but assuming that you did, all of the issues counsel just announced to you, you would not have the record from which you could decide the issues. Let me explain to you why. He referenced, or you referenced, Your Honor, about Asgood and Pernod. Those are two individual dealerships that there was a motion for leave to amend, and Judge Rube agreed with that and entered an order. They have not yet heard a motion on their demur. That has not yet been heard and decided, and yet they've taken an interlocutory appeal on that issue, and they've briefed it to this court when it has not yet been heard in the underlying court, and that record has not yet been transmitted to the circuit court, nor has it been transmitted to this court. That's why I call it the cart before the horse. I also call it the case with the blinders. They wanted to put blinders at the administrative proceeding, put blinders at the circuit court, and put blinders on this court, so that you may narrowly focus on only those issues to which they want you to resolve without having all of the facts and evidence. Let me go further on that point.
So let me just see if I understand your point, Mr.
Yes, sir.
And so you're saying that really there hasn't been a proper ruling on the demerit yet?
There have been no rulings except one, and that was on a plain, ordinary demerit. On one issue. There has not yet been a hearing on a demur
rest
on anything else.
Doesn't the record, though, before us establish that BADA is claiming representative standing in this case?
No, sir. The record establishes that BADA has asserted, has demonstrated, has ruled in one ruling that it has standing as an aggrieved party, and that's the only ruling that's been decided. And the best.
But does the record before us establish that BADA is a representative party representing dealerships, but without having a specific interest?
No, sir. The record establishes that BADA is a party through the record that's been established, for which you only have part of it, is actually a party that has been aggrieved, as demonstrated by the substantive facts and evidence to which you only have part of the record. And the best case, I submit to you, the best case that actually, in my opinion, my humble opinion, establishes what the principle of the cause is, and you have decided many, 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 many cases, including one of my cases, which is the Volkswagen case that's been cited here, Quinlan versus Volkswagen of America, but the best one is Lewis versus Lewis, the Supreme Court of Virginia, 2006, did the most thorough analysis, analyzing piece by piece how you decide what the principle of the cause is. Yes, I know it's a divorce case, and I know that they want to say that somehow the world is different when it's a VAPA case, but it isn't. The analysis, the Supreme Court did an exquisite analysis, piece by piece, of what the principle of the cause is. Yes, I know to them, the principle of the cause is standing from their viewpoint, but that's not what the Supreme Court did. The principle of the cause is what is the object of the matter. Standing is only one part of it. The principle of the cause is the entire administrative proceeding. Standing is but one matter. And the idea that the AG's office makes that sovereign immunity is somehow destroyed in the entire Commonwealth by this case, with all due respect, is poppycock. And I say that in this sense. The VAPA specifically, expressly anticipates waiver of sovereign immunity in a VAPA case. It does it every day. This court does it all the time, recognizing that in VAPA cases, there is a waiver of sovereign immunity in that class of cases. And if it turns out it's wrong and you disagree at the end of the case, you will say you're wrong. You don't have standing and you go back to square one. The world doesn't end.
Can I ask you, Mr. Weiss,
yes,
talking about the demurrer. Suppose the demurrer in this case had been granted. Would we have jurisdiction to hear that?
If the demurrer had been sustained, you mean? Yes, sir. Then I would have been out. My client would have been out. The case would have been over. I would have been out of court. My client would be out of court. And I would have had a right to appeal because there would have been nothing left to decide in that case. And then I would have a right to an appeal.
Would have adjudicated the principles of
yes,
the clause.
Yes, sir. The case would have been over. Final order would have been entered in that case. And I would have a right to appeal, which is what you see normally when you have those kind of standing cases that come before this case. It's the reverse. And so the question one might ask hypothetically is, why can't you do the reverse? And the answer is because you haven't adjudicated the entirety of the matter. And in this case, all they've determined, Judge Roop determined, was that the party was aggrieved. That's one step. We filed a petition for appeal. They haven't even responded to that, and they haven't transmitted the record. The record, according to Commissioner's counsel, the AG, had represented, it is so long, Judge Roop, you can read it for yourselves in the appendix, that it's going to take so long to transmit, we need additional time. I argued with them, and twice they asked Judge Roop for additional time, and then they took the strategy of doing an interlocutory appeal. The circuit court does not have the record.
Does that argument appear in your brief?
It does. If you ask me where it is in the brief, I don't have the citation with me here. I can tell you it's in the appendix. It's referenced in the actual transcript.
Not the appendix in your brief.
I believe it is, Your Honor. I don't have the citation. I can tell you this. I believe it is. I don't have the citation. I know it's in the appendix as well. If I may go further.
But being in the appendix is not the same as arguing it before this court on brief.
I don't have the citation in the brief. I believe it's in the brief. I know that we screamed about it. We filed a motion to dismiss on August 2nd with this court as well about the jurisdiction. I believe it was referenced in there as well. But
in your motion to dismiss?
Yes, sir. So I'll let the record stand. Whatever's in our brief is what is in our brief. Let me go further. And to the extent that they want to argue substantive issues, let me take an argument for a second. Let's assume I didn't raise it in the brief for a second. They're arguing issues that haven't even been briefed at the circuit court level. So let me pose rhetorically. How is it that we could be arguing issues at a court of appeals? Forget for a moment whether there was or wasn't a record that have not even been argued at the circuit court level.
Wasn't there a sufficient record before the trial court for it to determine that you do have standing?
There was enough for Judge Roop.
Isn't that enough for us?
If you decide that you have jurisdiction and you want to go that route without having the complete record as the Court of Appeals, you can certainly decide that you want to do that. If you want to decide that...
Well, no, I'm asking, is the record sufficient to allow us to do that?
That's for you to make that determination. I'm telling you what the record is and what the record isn't. And I submit to you that it is the obligation. In fact, I believe there's a rule that obligates the entire record to be transmitted to the Court of Appeals for review. If you decide that you're willing to review it with less than the entire record, that's up to you. I can't judge that for you.
That couldn't be the case in an appealable interlocutory order, because by their nature, the order is entered before the entire record is created.
And that creates the conundrum here, which is, how is it possible this could be an interlocutory appeal? Because if you look at what the 17.1 or 2, 405, subsection 4 is, I submit to you, based on every case I've read from this court and the Supreme Court, this cannot possibly be the basis for an interlocutory appeal, because it doesn't go to the principle of the cause.
Could you, you've got a little time remaining, and I'd like for you to address the, I guess, the substantive issue of why VADA does in fact have standing, why it isn't a grieved party in this case.
Okay, so I'll go with it with several reasons. So if you look at 46.2, I believe it's 1572 or 1573, number one, there's a reference in there inviting all interested parties to participate in the hearing, number one.
That makes you a party, but you have to be an aggrieved party. Those are two different concepts.
So I'm going to go through that analysis. So that invites to participate. Number two, VADA moved to intervene on the basis that in this case, different than all the general public, in this case, VADA had a contract, which was a settlement agreement, entered into back in 2012. The history of which was that Tesla had participated in an administrative proceeding for which it lost in 2012 and had taken an administrative appeal. During that appeal, to which VADA was not a party, Tesla and the commissioner invited VADA to participate in a settlement agreement to which they made them a party. In making them a party, there were certain conditions in that settlement agreement, which was a contract to which all the world was not a party. In doing so, they gave them rights, we assert, that no one else, that were distinguishable and an interest only to VADA, not the regular public. And that gave them rights that they were asserting as a party that they could use and argue in the administrative hearing, which they did, and which the commissioner referenced in his decision, right, wrong, or indifferent, for which Judge Roop found, as based on that, that they were an aggrieved party. In addition to that, in participating in that administrative proceeding, VADA, unlike the regular public, asserted that procedural violations occurred. In particular, they were not given access to discovery to which they were entitled to, and at the end, they won the administrative hearing, and the commissioner then overruled the hearing officer, and in doing so, the commissioner said that the dealers, two of which are parties in the underlying proceeding, as well as in the petition for appeal, did not prove something, which was a different standard than ever decided before, and that proof was something that required discovery that wasn't granted during the process. So it was a negative that had to be proven from evidence that Tesla would not turn over in the proceeding. Additional point. At the very beginning of this, the commissioner was required under the statute 46.2.1572, subsection 4, as the premise for a hearing, that there was no other dealer available for a manufacturer to consider in this case. Tesla wrote in their letter, which was January 13th of 2016, and it's cited in the brief as well as an attachment in the record, which is the appendix 000092 and 93, the letter they wrote, in which they expressly stated they had no intention of having dealers, nor do they have any dealers in the world. By definition, they could not meet the standard to have a hearing under 46.21572, I think is the statute, and therefore the commissioner could not legally have a basis to grant them a hearing and start the proceeding to begin with. It's either an error of law to begin with, which is another basis for the petition for review, or it's ultra vires act by the commissioner. I say that because the General Assembly many, many years ago took a position that it would have franchise dealers in the Commonwealth of Virginia. That is the entire basis of the statute, 46.21500. That is the premise of it. Tesla's premise is they have no franchise dealers anywhere in the world. I said at the beginning of the administrative hearing, I'll say it here again as well, if Tesla doesn't like the General Assembly's legislation, they were welcome to come here in Richmond to the General Assembly and move to change the law. The commissioner decided to change the law himself. That, I believe, was improper and ultra vires, which is another basis for the appeal for which VADA, unlike anyone else in the public, had a right that was distinguishable, personal injury to itself by that contract, as well as other injuries that occurred during that administrative proceeding. And that's what gave them the standing. I will say there was briefing with regard to representational standing, and the only additional argument I made in that regard as a subsidiary argument was in the Philip Morris case. If you look at the last page of the decision by the Supreme Court, it left open an avenue where there wasn't a statute, and I referenced that in passing. So if you look at the last page of the Philip Morris case by the Supreme Court of Virginia, it narrowly left open a gap there saying, we're only deciding this based on the statute. It did not decide representational standing in the absence of a statute, and I mentioned that in passing, but that is not the main reliance of my argument. Last point I'd like to make before I close on this. Counsel referenced the two dealers. The two dealers participated in the underlying administrative proceeding. They testified, they were cross-examined, they presented evidence. They were identified in the petition for appeal. The only thing that was missing was they weren't in the caption. And so there was a motion for leave to identify them in the caption. They were not strangers to the proceeding. That follows the Williams case. They contend in their briefing as if they were strangers to a proceeding being brought in. That issue has not been briefed in the circuit court at all. They want to argue it in this court without it having been briefed or decided in the circuit court. Assuming arguendo that VADA somehow didn't have standing, they still would in that court, even if VADA were knocked out, because under the Williams decision, they were already identified in the petition for appeal. They were already within the body of the decision, and it was a mere formality to move them up to the heading.
And there you're referring to Page?
Page and Asgard. Yes, sir. Thank you. Unless you have any other questions.
Any further questions for Mr. Weiss? I'm happy to give you additional time.
The only thing I would say is I ask you to grant the motion to dismiss. There's a lack of jurisdiction. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Allen, you have your 1 minute of rebuttal, and then Mr. Liflin, you have your 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the record below, Your Honor, the appendix will clearly show that there's a transcript of this hearing. At that time, the Commonwealth offered up the record to the judge, but we indicated to the judge that there were 3 days of testimony and three binders alone of transcripts. The demurrer contained over 800 pages of select portions of the record that, not the demurrer, the complaint upon which the demurrer was based.
Well, is the full administrative hearing a part of the record before us? Is that in the appendix?
No, sir.
That has been sitting, quite frankly, in the office of the Attorney General, Mr. Christian Parrish's office next to mine.
Isn't it your obligation as appellant to provide a complete record on appeal?
It is, but it never came into the circuit court because the circuit court judge asked for us not to submit it, that he felt he had enough in the complaint, which were selected portions of the record added to the complaint by Mr. Weiss to begin with. Okay, so this was a hearing on that demur, giving full faith to what was alleged in the demur and all the exhibits in the demur that Mr. Weiss put in. It was almost 900 pages. And the circuit court judge said he didn't want to see any more. He didn't think he needed to see anything more because we asked for an interlocutory appeal. And he surmised that until he needed to see it.
The case without that information, without that part of the record?
Well, we never got to the legal review that the court was to do based upon the substantial evidence standard, which is a relatively rote review, I would suggest, not unimportant, but rote and accepted.
We have to decide standing in order to make your argument work, your sovereign immunity argument work. If we don't have the complete record, how do we know whether there's not something in there that would support a finding of standing? In effect, the trial judge was maybe right for the wrong reason.
Well, you know from the complaint, Your Honor, that the ADA has never alleged that it has a pecuniary interest, that it sells automobiles, that it has one dealership in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It is no more than a professional association that the same way the Virginia Physical Therapy Association was, the Pearsall case, the Neighborhood Association was, and this court has ruled that those are not parties aggrieved, and that's the basis of our appeal.
But at the same time, I think, follow up on Judge Petty's question, we have the issue of Page and Askard as well.
Yes, but they came late in the game and they didn't meet the statutory requirements to file within 30 days. And because if the ADA filed and they were not the proper party, then that case is a nullity to begin with and they can't be added later. And that's the basis of our brief. And the record, by the way,
over your rebuttal, Todd said.
Yes.
Unless you,
I'd like to say one other thing.
All right.
The full record from the circuit court you have, okay? It's just that the circuit court never wanted the administrative record because of its sheer volume. And if you look in the transcript, you'll see that discussed. Nobody's hiding that.
Is
and we offered it up.
Is the circuit court judge, if this. If we say we don't have jurisdiction, if we say that, for an interlocutory appeal, is that record going to stay in the Attorney General's office or go to the Circuit Court?
I'm sorry. I was thinking ahead and I missed the question.
If we decide that we don't have jurisdiction for an interlocutory appeal now, is that record going to go to the Circuit Court?
Yes, certainly.
All of it will go there now?
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Yes.
Mr. Liplin?
Thank you, Your Honor. On the point about the record, I would just say you've got to consider what the motion below was. It was a demur to the pleading, and the record on that is the pleading and the legal arguments that are made in the briefs. That's all that's needed to decide that. You know, that's what a demur is. It's a challenge to the pleading. They have an obligation to plead the basis for their standing, to plead the basis for their piercing sovereign immunity. And if they haven't done that, that can be raised on a demur, and it was. And that's a sufficient basis for an appeal to appellate court to consider the question. Same thing with the motion to amend, to add the parties. That's a legal question. I don't understand what Mr. Weiss means when he says we're arguing questions that weren't presented to the court the question of whether they could properly be added under the Chesapeake House case, the question of whether they had standing on their own. Those were all briefed, and they were ruled on in the motion to amend. So they're all properly before the court. Mr. Weiss said it's poppycock that sovereign immunity is destroyed in this case. But I just refer your honors to the Pearsall case, where it says, in the context of administrative appeal, the reason you have to construe the Administrative Procedure Act standing requirements stringently and narrowly is because they are the flip side of sovereign immunity. That's the legislative limitation on who can challenge an administrative case decision. I will say on the contract, yes, there was a settlement agreement. It gave VADA rights. It did not give them rights to assert anything in an administrative hearing where the statutory question is the availability of other dealers or someone to operate a dealership in Richmond. It gave them rights under the contract. They asserted those in court. They were lost. They're doubly barred. They're barred by res judicata. They're barred by the fact that there's no waiver of sovereign immunity for contract claims of this kind by the state. So you can't just bootstrap that into an argument that you've had standing to appeal under the APA. There's another route for asserting those rights.
Mr. Lifton, can you wrap it up? Because I've let you all go well out of the year.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lifton. Thank you, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Mr.